I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. Years of litigation and pressure are paying off for immigrant families who've been held at a detention center in Berks County, Pennsylvania. It's one of only three in the nation where children unauthorized to live in the U.S. are detained. For more than a year and a half, Immigration and Customs Enforcement has held a group of women and their kids, some as young as three, inside the former senior center. As WHYY's Laura Benchoff tells us, a judge has now released four of these families, but ICE could pull them back at any time.
On a video conferencing screen at an immigration court in York County, a four-year-old boy appears. He's wearing a suit and coloring intently on a piece of paper while attorneys in a room 50 miles away argue over his case. There's no recording allowed in that court, so the boy tells me later in a restaurant near Reading what he said to the judge. I want to go with my mother. On Thursday, a judge released him, his mother, and a 16-year-old boy along with his mother. All fled violence in Central America and asked that their names not be used. A federal court decision in July found that all immigrant children in detention have the right to a hearing in immigration court. That's how a judge freed these families from the center, along with two others in the last 2 weeks. Immigration attorney Bridget Cambria argued their cases. She says their release comes at a time when the way the center runs is changing.
There's still long-term families. We have families around 6 months and under.
Since 2014, the Berks Family Residential Center has held dozens of families for more than a year. President Obama expanded family immigrant detention across the country in response to an influx of children and single parents from Central America. Cambria says the Berks Family Detention Center is now running more like it did before the surge.
It is converting sort of more into a processing center. It's mostly male, so we find that most of the people are passing and leaving and, you know, reuniting with sponsors.
However, ICE has appealed the release of families held there long term. The Board of Immigration Appeals has granted them a stay, meaning children and their parents who were just let go could wind up back in the center until the appeal is decided. ICE officials declined to comment on the pending litigation. In immigration court, the agency's attorney argued that under federal immigration law, the judges who freed them didn't have the right to make that decision. But at least for now, this four-year-old boy will be staying with a sponsor in Jenkintown. And because a judge sided with him, his mother will be there too. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
The tragic events in Charlottesville are once again focusing attention on matters relating to race. NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller has enlisted the help of Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll, to get the public's opinion.
Frank, quite simply, how concerned are Americans about race relations?
Well, you know, there are two answers to that question. When we ask Americans repeatedly year after year some questions where we bring up race relations, we have seen a decided and sharp uptick in concern. One of those questions we ask every year is, how satisfied are you with the state of race relations? And we noticed right after 2014, and that was the year, of course, when Ferguson, Missouri happened, and other racial incidents, that percent satisfied started to go down and down and down, and the percent dissatisfied started going up and up. Let me give you some numbers. It was about 40% who were dissatisfied prior to 2014, 2015, this decade. But in recent years, that's gone up into the 60% range. And this year, and of course, this was prior to Charlottesville that we measured it, 72% were dissatisfied with race relations. There's some other measures, however, not quite so dramatic, and that's open-endedly. What's the most important problem facing the country? There we haven't seen a big change. I mean, we had 52% of Americans today back in 1964 thought race relations was the most important problem facing the country. But most recently this year, we found 7%, to be precise, a couple of weeks ago, of Americans open-endedly volunteered that race relations was the top problem facing the country. So it's a big problem when we remind people about it. It is still not top of mind as the most significant problem in the country.
There is this uptick, and then it goes back down in terms of attention and awareness. And when you say a heightened awareness about race relations, is the ultimate wish that Americans just want to wish it away and not talk about it?
Well, I'm not sure if we can probe the psyche of the average American to that degree to know whether they want to wish it away. However, we have asked a question, Dave, which is a little different, which is, will race relations always be a problem in the U.S., or will a solution eventually be found? And that question was asked by Gallup long before I came along, and that, too, has gone up and down over the years. But back earlier on in our history, we had, let's say even in the 90s, with the O.J. Simpson trial and some other things, less than half of Americans thought that a solution would eventually be found. But more recently, we're up well above a majority of Americans who still are positive that a solution to the race problem in this country will eventually be found.
Frank, let's put that aside. We're getting closer and closer to back-to-school season. And regarding colleges and universities, let's look at the nexus of higher education and politics.
You know, we've talked so much, Dave, about how everything is political these days. We ask Americans, how's the economy? How are your personal finances doing? And Republicans now have flipped and are much more positive than Democrats because as a Republican in the White House, it was a lot different when Obama was in the White House. We are now seeing that creep into perceptions of colleges and universities. A 20-point gap now in confidence that Americans express in those words, those three words, colleges and universities. Democrats 56% confident, Republicans 33% confident in higher education. And sure enough, when we said to Republicans, why aren't you confident in colleges and universities, they came back, too liberal, too political. Colleges are pushing their own agendas and not letting the students learn what they want to. Colleges are teaching their students the wrong types of things. These are the talking points that have been picked up by the average Republican out there who now look askance at higher education. Although when we ask Democrats who say they have low confidence in colleges and educations, they're actually more likely to come back with the kind of practical responses that you just mentioned. They say, well, I'm down on colleges because it's much too expensive for what you get, and that it doesn't lead to good jobs for those who are coming out the other end. So if you're a Democrat listening to this, your views of colleges are much more circling around those kind of practical issues. Is it worth the money, basically? Whereas if you're a Republican and listening to us right now, Dave, you're more likely to say, colleges and universities, I view them ideologically as moving too far to the left.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
A decades-long effort to clean up the Chesapeake Bay has been showing signs of success, but the progress made could be hindered by a dam in northern Maryland. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports the dam has been holding back pollution for nearly a century, but scientists say it won't be able to keep up the work for much longer.
The bright yellow neon sign reading Conowingo Hydroelectric Plant has been a landmark on top of the dam since it came online in the late 1920s.
Conowingo Dam is the largest source of renewable power in Maryland.
Colleen Hicks works for Exelon, which owns the dam. She explains how the Susquehanna River, the bay's largest tributary, turns its turbines, creating enough electricity for about 250,000 homes. Like all dams, this one has created a reservoir behind it. And as a side benefit, the reservoir keeps sediment from washing downstream, where it can harm aquatic life.
The river starts in Cooperstown, New York, and flows into the Chesapeake Bay.
In 2010, the EPA imposed strict new pollution limits on state and local governments. The goal is to sharply curb nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment by the year 2025. It was believed the Conowingo Dam would continue trapping sediment until then. But Bill Ball of the Chesapeake Research Consortium says scientists recently concluded the dam isn't trapping sediment like it used to.
It is now at a point where it's essentially effectively full. The capacity's been reached.
That's why Maryland just announced a $4 million pilot program to dredge behind the dam. Ben Grumbles heads the state's Department of the Environment.
If you don't deal with the sediment problem, you're going to have a really hard time meeting the more aggressive cleanup goals.
Grumbles says sediment is not the only problem. Controlling pollution before water even reaches the dam is critical. His counterpart to the north, Secretary Patrick McDonnell of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, says his agency will keep focusing on cleaning up local waterways.
There's no reason for us to stop any of that work. And in fact, we need to double down on that work and make sure we're dealing with our own impairments. In doing that, a lot of the bay piece, from our perspective, starts to take care of itself.
But Grumbles feels dredging is so important, Maryland might veto Exelon's pending application to relicense the dam if the company doesn't do enough to find a solution.
Our state has a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to make sure that as Exelon seeks a 46-year renewal of its license, that the state use its ability to negotiate with the
Exelon says it supports efforts to find long-lasting solutions to deal with the sediment issue. But if the state calls for a larger-scale dredging operation, it's unclear how much of the tab the company would have to pick up.
We can't simply assume that we've got a spigot that we can turn off or not turn off by virtue of dredging.
Andy Miller, a professor with the University of Maryland, says this problem goes back centuries. In fact, research shows at one point farming and deforestation caused so much sediment to wash downstream, it added nearly 800 acres to Maryland. Miller says a major dredging operation now would be an expensive and temporary solution.
You bought yourself a short period of time, after which you'll be back in the same boat. That, to me, is not necessarily money well spent.
Besides the federal government, the District of Columbia and six states, including Pennsylvania, are all working together on many fronts to curb pollution from the 64,000-acre watershed. The Conowingo Dam is important, but Bill Ball of the Chesapeake Research Consortium says it's only one piece of a very big puzzle.
And it's important to separate the issues of who pays, where it's done, and what is done. So where it's done and what is done are science questions. Who pays is a political question.
With sediment now washing over the dam regularly, that political question has become a pressing matter. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
We're 3 days out from the Great American Total Solar Eclipse, which will darken skies all the way from Oregon to South Carolina along a stretch of land around 70 miles wide. Dr. Paul Halpern, physics professor at the University of the Sciences, joined Newsworks Tonight's Dave Heller to give us a better understanding of the event.
So what are the physics behind a solar eclipse?
Well, we're lucky that Earth's system has the strange property that our moon, in terms of its disk size, can line up with the sun. Our moon's disk is about the same size as the sun's disk. And that's just an astonishing coincidence. So if the moon was much larger or much smaller, and if it was further away or closer, you wouldn't get exactly the same effect. And that means that when the moon passes in front of the sun relative to Earth, it can block out the light from the sun, and that's when we experience a solar eclipse.
And the delight for scientists is it then reveals the corona.
Yes. Yeah, so scientists are very enticed by solar eclipses because we can study the sun in ways that we can't do other times.
When was the first total solar eclipse recorded?
Something like 5,000 years ago.
And they actually happen more frequently than one would consider, just that most of them are not in certainly the Philadelphia region.
Yes, if one had a private jet, you could fly out to all the total solar eclipses that happen. But if you're going to stay in one area, you don't really experience too many in your lifetime.
Talk about some of the major findings through history to date that we've learned observing the sun during an eclipse.
Well, a solar eclipse is what made Einstein famous back in 1919. So Einstein was working on his theory of general relativity, which was his description of gravitation. And his description would end up revolutionizing the idea of gravitation by saying that space curves, and because of the curvature of space, that's why we feel gravity. And the old idea was Newton's idea, which was called action at a distance, where gravity was something like an invisible string pulling the Earth and the sun together. So Einstein wanted to test his theory, and one brilliant way he thought of testing it was to measure the bending of starlight by the sun. Well, the problem with that idea is that during the daytime, you don't see the stars, and at nighttime, you don't see the sun. So how to measure the bending of starlight by the sun? Well, the best way to do that is during a total solar eclipse. So Einstein's assistant, Erwin Friedrich Freundlich, decided to organize an expedition in 1914 to test an early version of Einstein's theory. So Friedrich Freundlich went to Crimea, and on the way, World War I broke out, and he was promptly arrested by the Russians for being a German spy. So he never quite measured the 1914 solar eclipse, which turned out to be good news for Einstein because Einstein had made a mistake in his calculations. And once he corrected the mistake, his prediction for the angle of starlight bending turned out to be about twice as much as his original prediction.
So when was Einstein's theory ultimately confirmed?
Well, in 1919, Arthur Eddington, who was a famous British physicist, organized two expeditions to observe the eclipse and to finally confirm Einstein's theory. So in November 1919, Einstein was proclaimed the successor to Newton. and a revolution in gravitation was announced around the world.
And so is the major scientific work still to be done, making observations and calculations about the sun or about the Earth or the solar system or other solar systems?
Well, there are projects underway to measure aspects of the sun and aspects of the Earth. So NASA has designated research projects for terrestrial research and for solar research. And one important thing that's going to be measured by the solar eclipse of August 21st is the idea of how much solar energy reaches Earth, how much of it bounces off of Earth, and how that is affected by a sudden drop in light. And normally that happens through clouds, but clouds are kind of amorphous. Here we get a very, very discrete effect where the sun's light is suddenly blocked by a disk, and we can measure exactly how much the solar energy drops. So there are experiments being done in Wyoming and Missouri, terrestrial observations, and then in space through satellites to measure how much sunlight hits the Earth, bounces off of Earth, and how that is affected by the darkening due to the eclipse.
Thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
My pleasure, Dave.
Dr. Paul Halpern, physics professor at the University of the Sciences in Philadelphia.
Retired Pennsylvania science teacher Stephen Burr made plans 2 years ago to witness this year's solar eclipse in Driggs, Idaho. He reserved a hotel room and invited family members, but prepared as he was, life had different plans. After a life-threatening bout with pneumonia and many health complications, he won't be able to go. But he's had eclipse adventures to fill entire books, perhaps the most stunning of them, a star-studded trip in 1973 to witness the sun's darkening off the coast of West Africa. WHYY's Mike and Scott has more.
The Canberra ocean liner was loaded with science lovers and some of the greatest and most famous science minds of the time. Astronauts Neil Armstrong and Scott Carpenter, scientist and prolific writer Isaac Asimov. Stephen Burr was in his 30s then, and he made a short film about the trip, which he narrated.
The SS Canberra sailed from New York with a capacity cargo of almost 2,000 people and over $1 million worth of scientific equipment on June 22nd, 1973.
Even though money was tight, Stephen and his wife Barbara Burr had decided this was the opportunity of a lifetime.
We got the cheapest stateroom, no windows or anything like that. I think we paid
$800. $800, and we had two little kids, and my mother watched the kids in Brooklyn, and we went, and it was a floating college.
Free lecture tickets were more valuable than money. Neil Armstrong, the first man on the moon, and Scott Carpenter, an astronaut and modern exploration pioneer, were popular lecturers.
It was an incredible trip. We went all the way across the ocean.
Days passed without land in sight, spent listening to lectures or trying out different telescopes. Eventually, the Canberra positioned itself off the coast of Mauritania, the perfect spot to witness the eclipse. Burr says the decks were a forest of telescopes and cameras. Excitement grew.
Until the sun finally disappeared behind the moon in a magnificent diamond ring.
You know, when you see it from the ocean, it is big. It's like big in the ocean. It seemed so low. It seemed almost like I can touch it. And it was beautiful and it was cool. It gets cool and it gets darker and you see other stars. And it's very special. You know, you really feel, what am I seeing? Listen to me.
Stephen Burr says all of the passengers were trying to get close to Isaac Asimov, who had told everybody that he was an eclipse virgin.
So the eclipse began, and he shouts out, "My God, they're right. The stars do shine during the day."
Everybody has their cameras and viewers and telescopes. He's standing there with his hands behind his back, nothing, no camera, nothing, just taking it in.
The magic moment that time can only enhance.
That was WHYY's Mike and Scott reporting. The Burr's son, Jonathan, will lead a group of 30 relatives on the trip his father had planned for this year to see the eclipse in Idaho. And they'll be FaceTiming the whole event so that Stephen and Barbara can watch from home. We'll also hear from enthusiasts making pilgrimages to the See the Eclipse on Monday's show. Some Temple University College of Engineering students are headed to Kentucky with a weather balloon outfitted to live stream the eclipse. And the Franklin Institute's Derek Pitts will join us live from the scene in St. Joseph's, Missouri. And that's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. WHYY's news director is Eugene Son. Our assistant news director is Katie Colinari. John Musoni is assistant vice president for news operations. Our engineer this week was Bob Alls. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan for NewsWorks Tonight.